Studio 360 is supported by Sotheby's Institute of Art, the Graduate School of Art and its markets, offering master's degrees and public programs for aspiring art world professionals at their campuses in New York, Los Angeles, London, and online. Sotheby'sInstitute.com. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Behind almost every great pop music star is a great producer. And today on Studio 360, we'll meet two of them. The enigmatic young musician who goes by the name Boots helped write some of Beyoncé's most personal current songs.
The only reason why she and I worked so well together is because something that I had to say resonates very deeply with her. And it's great that it happened, and it's amazing that it happened.
And the man who gave the career of Celia Cruz a reboot in the 1970s and, in the process, invented salsa, Johnny Pacheco.
Tito would say, Johnny, pero que la salsa se come and no se toca. We eat salsa. We don't dance it. We don't play it.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360. But to start the show, last week, Sony Pictures suffered a huge cyber attack on its computer network. Someone or something identifying itself as Guardians of Peace took over Sony's computers, stole and released personnel files, and put unreleased movies online. Almost immediately, a suspect emerged: the government of North Korea. North Korea has been angry about Sony's imminent movie, The Interview, a comedy starring Seth Rogen and James Franco as CIA-recruited journalists trying to assassinate the country's dictator, Kim Jong-un.
You want us to assassinate the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What? Barbara Demick was the Los Angeles Times bureau chief in both Beijing and Seoul, South Korea, where she reported on North Korea for years. She's also the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Barbara, thanks for talking to me today.
Happy to be here.
So in this movie, James Franco plays a vain news anchor. Seth Rogen is his goofy producer, and the CIA recruit them to assassinate Kim Jong-un. It is a comedy, but North Korea has been calling it an act of war, that they would undertake merciless retaliation. Why are the North Koreans so upset about this film?
Well, they hold their leadership holy. And Kim Jong-un, like his father, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, the grandfather, before them, are godlike figures in North Korea. I mean, it would almost be like blasphemy against Mohammed.
Right. Well, and we see where that gets people.
And you can see where that's gotten people.
Yeah.
And, you know, anything that's an attack on the leadership is very sensitive.
Right.
And, you know, they're also, the North Koreans are also very upset that the UN Commission on Inquiry has suggested bringing the leadership to International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. You know, it's interesting, this is not the first time North Korea has been parodied in film.
Right.
I don't know if you remember, you know, Team America.
10 years ago.
Yeah,
one of my favorites.
Yeah, I mean, Kim Jong-il was an alien cockroach, and Red Dawn, the remake of Red Dawn, which was originally going to feature a Chinese villain, was rewritten to use the North Koreans instead because, well, they wanted to distribute the film in China. So they've been kind of an easy target. I find it sort of a positive development for North Korea that they're so upset about it, because it shows, you know, frankly, that they're engaging with the rest of the world. And if they don't want to be picked on, if they don't want to be made fun of, if they don't want to be hauled before the International Criminal Court, you know, maybe they better get their act together, join the rest of the world, and, you know, treat their people decently.
So these hackers apparently did not have a financial incentive. They didn't apparently steal credit card numbers and the things that happen in these massive corporate hacks usually. But what's the evidence that the North Koreans are behind this attack?
They have done this type of attack before. They were the main suspect behind a 2013 attack on South Korean banks that featured the same kind of things, you know, sort of flashing skulls and
really
weird imagery.
Huh.
So, you know, they've been caught at it before.
Do you have a gut instinct about whether they did this?
My gut instinct is that they did.
Yeah.
And that they're snickering about it, that they're quite proud, because they have a reputation as a you know, technical backwater. This is the only country in the world that has deliberately taken itself off the internet. Most North Koreans don't even know what the internet is.
Right. And some people have said, well, no, it's probably not North Korea because they are such a backwater.
They have very well-trained technical people. I've actually met some of them when I was interviewing defectors for my book. A defector in 2004 claimed they had something called Unit 121 doing hacking. On several trips that I've been to North Korea, we've had excellent internet.
One thing that occurred to me, given that it is Sony, a Japanese company, and given the ancient and recent bad blood between the Koreas and Japan, maybe that's part of it?
It could be. That hadn't occurred to me, but I'm sure it's occurred to the North Koreans. They don't like the Japanese.
So we know that Kim Jong-un, like his father before him, is somewhat obsessed with movies and with Hollywood. Why is film such a big deal to this dynasty?
Well, Kim Jong-il especially saw film as, you know, the greatest propaganda tool ever invented. In fact, he wrote a book called On the Art of Cinema, or at least his name is on it. And he had this large movie studio built in the outskirts of North Korea. At one point, he actually kidnapped a South Korean film director
right.
to have him do a film for North Korea. I mean, a completely absurd story. So they like movies, and movies are, you know, one of their points of access to the outside world, although so much foreign media is banned in North Korea. You know, we know that the elite get smuggled, probably pirated DVDs in across the border from China.
Well, and it certainly, the other thing is, apart from North Korea's motives, it has given enormous attention to this film. It's a very expensive but probably very effective marketing thing for Sony Pictures.
Well, there's a conspiracy theory for you. You know, I would imagine that some of this is, you know, faux outrage on their part. I don't think they think that this movie is really going to encourage somebody to assassinate Kim Jong-un.
Right.
But, you know, they like attention, too, and this is their way of getting it.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, sure. Very happy to talk about North Korea. I always am.
Barbara Demick is a visiting press fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the book Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea.
The CIA would love it if you two could take him out.
Take him out?
Like for drinks?
No. Take him out.
This year, film historians made a really remarkable discovery. It was in an unmarked can of film that had been just sitting in a back room since 1938, which was the year the new Museum of Modern Art acquired everything out of the vault of the old Biograph silent film studio.
And the inventories indicate that there were 7 reels of unidentified, just said unidentified on it. No titles, and these were negatives, so it's not something you could look at right away and identify.
That's Ron Magliosi. He's a curator in MoMA's film department.
And they were unassembled, with no production records, no main titles, no intertitles.
It took MoMA decades just to sort through all the films from Biograph. It wasn't until 1976 that they got around to taking a close look at those 7 unidentified reels.
And that's when they identified Burt Williams as the star of this unknown film.
Which makes it the first feature film ever to star an African-American. Burt Williams was a vaudeville superstar of his time, the first black member of the Ziegfeld Follies.
So when I realized it was a Burt Williams film, I was determined to find out what it was.
What's still a little mysterious is why that curator in the 1970s who found it just stuck it back on the shelf.
It's hard to say. She had a lot to do. She identified it as Burt Williams. She called it Picnic.
Last year, Magliosi went through the negative frame by frame. Until this discovery, there were only 2 known short films starring Burt Williams. This feature, the picnic footage, was never finished or released. And that may be because of another movie. D.W. Griffith's notorious big-budget picture, Birth of a Nation, which glorified the Ku Klux Klan.
The 2 Burt Williams films that were released, Natural Born Gambler and Fish, were released in 1916, a year after Birth of a Nation came out. And if I can say it this way, those were racist enough to get by with audiences by 1916.
Huh.
When you compare those to this film, you'll see the ways in which this film presents perhaps too positive a view of a black performance, black life.
Well, should we take a look?
I think we should start, yeah.
A new installation at MoMA puts that unedited footage in front of the public for the first time.
So we're in a barbershop. There are lots of black characters. Burt Williams is the only one in blackface.
Yes. This was the standard for a lot of the black touring companies, that the lead comics in these companies would wear blackface. And the rest of the cast was kind of gave the rest of the cast permission not to be in blackface.
In case you didn't catch that, Burt Williams, although he was black, performed in blackface in the old minstrel tradition. I'd asked the writer Carol Phillips to come to the screening with me. One of Phillips' novels, Dancing in the Dark, is about Burt Williams' life. Like Williams, Phillips was born in the Caribbean and emigrated as a boy.
Carol, have you seen Burt Williams' films?
I've seen both Fish and A Natural Born Gambler.
And does this, as Ron suggested, seem less racist?
What's interesting about this film is the dignity and the joy which seems to be surrounding the life of the black characters.
Did he deal with criticism about performing in blackface?
There was tremendous criticism, and it grew. It grew in his, you know, towards the end of his career, we were beginning to see the end of the blackface tradition. And of course, Burt Williams' prominence as the most famous African-American performer, there was a tremendous pressure on him to do the right thing and to abandon the burnt cork. He was a very solitary man. He was a man of great dignity. He was a man who drank alone. But he was an outsider in all sorts of ways. He was from the Caribbean. He didn't consider himself to be fully a part of the African-American tradition. So in a sense, he didn't see or perhaps quite understand the full implications of the blackface performance. He didn't see it as demeaning.
Right.
He saw it as part of his costume. But the sociopolitical and cultural times were saying, this is old school.
Right.
This is not acceptable anymore.
Right. And he was saying, wait, you're trying to ruin my career.
This is what I do. And actually, you're wrong, because it's not undignified. And people know me as this performer. People love me. They buy my recordings. They come to my performances. Perhaps you're the one with the problem.
In its current raw form, the movie's a little hard to follow. The footage was never edited, and there are no title cards, which the silent movies always had. But it's basically a romantic comedy, not unlike some Buster Keaton plots. Burt Williams wants the girl, but has to compete with two seemingly more worthy or boring suitors.
So now you're seeing a series of contests. You're going to see a grease pig contest. There's a watermelon eating contest.
I've never seen a source of the term of art, catching a grease pig, but here it is.
Check out the Actors Fun Field Day and you'll see another one.
I think an animal was harmed in the production of this.
This film is an important find for a few reasons. It's the earliest surviving footage of any American feature film with a black cast. And there's an elaborate cakewalk scene, which is evidently the earliest record of vernacular African-American dance. And despite the blackface makeup, Burt Williams' character is not some minstrel stereotype.
And there's the two tramp characters in the middle. I mean, they're the performance extreme in the film. The two tramp characters are clowns. Burt's not a clown in this film. Burt's the romantic lead, in a sense. He's the romantic, I mean, just the way Keaton and Chaplin were with their eccentric costumes and their eccentric mannerisms. They still get the girl
right
in their films, and as you see, Burt gets the girl in this film.
It's very sweet. He takes her out, they eat chicken and ice cream, and ride together on a merry-go-round.
It's a mature relationship, certainly within the context of silent comedy. It's a mature relationship.
The rejected suitors try to get back at Williams, unsuccessfully.
So despite the fact that he's been accused of a crime and ashamed in front of the whole community, she sticks with him. They're still a couple.
Now he's taken her back to her house, I guess.
Yes.
So they both look around to make sure no one's looking to see if they can kiss.
And that's it.
Fantastic. So, Carol Phillips, mm-hmm. a man who spent many months and hours and thousands of hours in the head of Burt Williams and his life, what do you think?
I think it's a remarkable discovery. It would have changed, I have to be honest. I think it would have changed something about the way in which I was thinking about Burt Williams over a couple of years. Because the central question is always, did he need the blackface in order to perform? He's performing in blackface at the end of the blackface tradition. Burt's internal justification to himself, and his sometimes retort to the world is, it is part of my character, I need it, my audiences will know who I am if I'm in blackface, I need to do this. Watching this film, I feel he didn't need to do it. He's actually a good enough performer. He didn't need the blackface.
Right now, the Museum of Modern Art in New York is showing that footage of Burt Williams' 1913 silent film. The installation is called 100 Years in Post-Production, Resurrecting a Lost Landmark of Black Film History. I spoke with novelist Carol Phillips and film curator Ron Magliosi. You can see a little bit of that film at studio360.org, and filmmakers, musicians, artists, all of you. The Museum of Modern Art would love to give you access to any and all of the footage to make new work out of it. The contact information is at studio360.org. Coming up, how do you stay true to yourself when you're suddenly writing hits for the world's biggest pop star? Drunk in love. The producer Jordan Asher, who goes by Boots, performs live in our studio. That's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Sotheby's Institute of Art, the graduate school of art and its markets, offering master's degrees and public programs for aspiring art world professionals at their campuses in New York, Los Angeles, London, and online. Sotheby'sInstitute.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. All this year, we've been checking in on four of you listeners who made creative New Year's resolutions for 2014, an advertising executive who wanted to do stand-up comedy again, a lawyer whose sidelines is a painter, a rock star with a wild idea for a musical theater piece. And a listener named Gabriel Walker, who resolved to move from little Maysville, Kentucky to Louisville to form a band and perform. And he is here with me now on the line. Hi, Gabriel.
Hello. It's nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk with you again, too. So I'm reaching you in Louisville, which was step one. Check. You've been working there for a while with a singer, Jen Rose Fitzgerald. What have you two been up to?
We were writing original songs. Originally, when you and I had talked, I had said something about doing cover songs.
Wow, so this has gotten a lot more ambitious.
It's gotten a lot more ambitious. We scored some serious musicians. These guys are all seasoned session players. And as we bring it to them, they bring it to life in ways that I couldn't even have imagined. I'm just delighted.
And you're working right now toward a performance in a few weeks?
Yes. In fact, we have a date. It's December 20th. It's going to be in Louisville at a place called the Open Gallery. We're one of several acts on the bill. We're going to open. Now, originally, we had talked about doing a six-song set. We may end up with five original songs, but I'll take it.
And so will we. Now, another one of the goals you and I talked about before was that you're going to work on your own singing voice. How's that going?
You know, I was so afraid you were going to bring that up. Well, it works like this. With Jen Rose singing and holding down all the lyric writing, I haven't even touched singing. I have focused mostly on songwriting, mostly on my guitar playing, and I'm actually okay with it. I found out I write much better than I had thought I would.
Really?
And I'm enjoying it so much. Oh, yeah.
You sent us a recording of a work in progress, which is a song called Paris, and I want to play a little bit of that for us now.
Okay.
Standing there, you look so debonair, but I'm not a girl who's fast to fall. You, you're just a little too Fred Astaire, and I'm too Miss Bacall. Yeah, you, you're just a little too Fred Astaire, that's all.
That is Jen Rose Fitzgerald with Gabriel Walker's band, Singing Paris. It sounds beautiful. It also reminded me, as I listened to it, of music of my youth. I thought of Maria Muldaur.
I love that you mentioned her. I still have a crush on her.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds like you really have changed your life in a big way, right? I mean, moving to Louisville, finding this collaborator, having a show. I mean, this is not just, I did this work I've been meaning to do. It's kind of a big right turn for you.
This is very interesting. You guys at 360 have provided me with something that I really needed, which is basically a kick in the backside. It's been quite an ordeal to get here, but I've been so determined to do this, and it's working out so much better than I ever would have imagined. And I don't want to give it up. I love it.
Great. Well, happy to have kicked you. and have a great show. We will send somebody to record it, and I can't wait to hear the live performance.
Oh, thank you so much. I am really grateful to you.
Well, thanks for playing along, and best of luck.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll always have Paris, you say to me.
At Studio360.org, we've got the details about where you can hear Gabriel Walker perform later this month in Louisville. I am talking to you, WFPL listeners. And since we're about to close the books on this year, we want to know, what's your creative New Year's resolution for 2015? Maybe it's to finish that novel, or pick up the violin again, or write a comic book. Whatever it is, tell us about your 2015 resolution on our website. We might just hold you to it. Just last week, the current Queen of Pop released a deluxe CD edition of her album Beyoncé. It already broke records for digital sales when it was first released a year ago.
Sometimes these walls seem to cave in on me when I look in your
The producer behind the album's most personal songs was practically unknown at the time. A young guy from Florida who'd been quietly making something of a name for himself in the pop music world. My radio brother Sean Ramasvaram got the first radio interview with the producer, who goes by the name Boots.
When Beyoncé dropped Beyoncé last year without telling anyone it was coming, the internet erupted with questions. How'd she keep this thing a secret? How long has she been working on this? And who the hell is Boots? Boots was listed all over the album, alongside people like Timbaland, Sia, Frank Ocean, and Pharrell. Everyone knew who those people were. No one knew who Boots was. So far, that mystery is the best thing that's ever happened to Jordy Asher. Jordy's from Florida. He grew up in Miami. In 2009, he was finally old enough to enter bars to play with his bluesy bar band, Stone Fox. That band evolved into a better one called Blonde Fuzz, which then became Young Circles, a band that was down to get a little weirder.
Sleepy sheepy smile, throw him in the Nile.
Young Circles started to get attention in 2011, and most of that attention was on Jordy, the band's frontman. But Jordy never seems to stick around in one place too long. At 25, Jordy moved to New York and became Boots. And pretty soon after that, Boots got signed to Roc Nation, that one label owned by that guy my mom likes to call Beyoncé's husband. Boots won't say how Beyoncé heard his songs, but we know that she liked what he was cooking. He wrote and produced her recent album's most personal songs, Blue, which is about her daughter, Heaven, which is about her miscarriage, and Haunted, which is about her being fed up with the music industry.
I don't trust these record labels, I'm torn. All these people on the planet working 9 to 5 just to stay alive, the 9 to 5 just to stay alive.
You know, the only reason why she and I worked so well together is because something that I had to say resonates very deeply with her, and it's great that it happened, and it's amazing that it happened.
And it was obviously great publicity. Slate, Vogue, BuzzFeed, they all started posting about Boots, a rising musician's dream come true, but with a fair amount of nightmarish hyperbole. Pitchfork called him Beyoncé's muse. BuzzFeed overstated how much credit he was due for the album. Reporters started calling his parents' house, looking for pictures of him. And people started following him around Brooklyn.
Yeah, but it was to go from like none of that to a lot of that. I kind of didn't take it well. That's what I will say about it. So that's why it's a little bit like the association now. I'm in a very different place.
As in, he's done talking about Beyoncé. Boots is getting ready to drop an album, and he sincerely wants it to melt your face off.
Shadows up his spine, I was lying every time. Daggers in your eyes, hit the devil on the line. Shadows up his spine, I was lying every time. Daggers in your eyes, hit the devil on the line.
Mercy's the most ferocious song Boots has ever released, but when he came into our studio, he toned it down for us on the piano. Here's the full song.
Tuck my gun into your waist. Suck your thumb, cry off your face. Cause we're losing light. Yeah, you're losing light. All my club and moral dreams, all the hero worship, kings and queens are dead and gone. Yeah, they're dead and gone. Get the devil on the line. Shivers up my spine, I was lying every time. Daggers in my eyes, get the evil off my screen, off my toes. Tuck my gun into your waist. Suck your thumb, dry off your face. Cause we're losing light. Yeah, we're losing light. Float your photo down the stream. Take a mercy shot at mercy. Me a poet's dream. The glowing seeds of grown disease. Up a spine, I was lying every time. daggers in your eyes. Get the devil on the line. Ooh, shivers up your spine. I was lying every time. Daggers in your eyes. Get the devil on the line.
That was Boots playing his song Mercy. So is that going to be on the album?
Yes, it will be. I will say that that is the first song on the album.
What's the song about?
Well, I think the main sentiment is I'm asking people to pay attention.
And Boots found another way to get people to pay attention. He replaced all of the songs on his SoundCloud with Mercy. That's a bummer if you were into the mixtape he released earlier this year, but go figure Boots would find an original, sort of confusing way to promote his upcoming album. He's going to end the year on a national tour with FKA Twigs, but of course, he'll do it in his own enigmatic way.
And you're going to be in some bus or something?
No.
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 You're going to be in a van? What's it going to be?
No, I don't know.
Bus, van, car.
Come on, man. I'm not like all those other people. I'm gonna go in whatever feels rad to drive in. I want to drive on the road.
Okay. Wait, I'm sorry. I'm not a professional musician, as you can tell.
No, I'm sure that
how often do
most people
actually
will
drive
be
themselves on tour?
Nobody. But I want to.
My cassette don't play these songs. I run roulette. If you don't know, keeping it close. If you don't go, I might run a run roulette.
That was Studio 360's Sean Ramos-Furum talking to the producer known as Boots. Sean's had lots of great conversations with lots of interesting artists on our spin-off podcast Sideshow, and you can find them and see videos of Boots performing live and unplugged just for us, all at studio360.org/sideshow. Coming up, Lisa Kudrow spent a decade playing Phoebe on Friends. She's not Phoebe-ish at all, but after a while, playing such a space cadet did take a toll.
I lost a lot of vocabulary. That was actually happening before. I think that happened from deciding to become an actor.
She is up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360.
I'm going to start off with a little song called Smelly Cat. Smelly Cat, Smelly Cat.
That's Lisa Kudrow playing Phoebe Buffay on the sitcom Friends. But in the decades since that series, she hasn't been just living off her friend's fortune. In 2008, Kudrow was something of an internet pioneer when she created the online series Web Therapy, which ultimately got turned into a TV show for Showtime. And now, after what must be the longest hiatus ever between seasons of a TV series, she's back on HBO, starring in the second season of The Comeback. It's about an ex-sitcom actress who's doing a reality show in the hope of getting back in the game.
Turn the cameras off, so you missed the call from my agent, okay? Never turn the cameras off.
You told us to.
Well, Tyler, not now, okay? You're going to harsh my mellow. You know what? Why don't I just do the call again? Right? I can fake it. I'm an actress, yeah? According to HBO, I'm an amazing dramatic actress, so who knew?
Good for you, man. We're back on TV.
Well, no, it's not TV. They don't do that anymore, do they? Okay. In 5, 4, 3. Someone say ring.
Oh, ring! Oh,
it's my agent. This is Valerie Cherish.
I spoke with Lisa Kudrow in 2009, shortly before, as it happens, she gave the best commencement address I've ever seen at Vassar, her alma mater. When we talked in the studio, she told me she hadn't set out to be an actor. In college, she was a biology major.
I didn't act at all. In
really?
High school, college, none of it, wouldn't have any part of it.
Well, before you decided that you would have some part of it, what drew you to biology?
Oh, well, my father's a doctor, and I always admired him so much, and then found it really interesting. In high school, I was studying biology, and I thought that it was going to, you know, be the answer to unlocking all the mysteries of humanity.
Well, it could have been, I suppose.
Yeah, it could have been. I mean, I kind of laugh because, you know, nothing really does.
So you go to college, you're going to be some kind of scientist, neuroscientist, no interest in acting. At what point and how did that change of career plan happen?
After I graduated, I was working for my father. He was a headache specialist. I was doing research
in Southern California.
In Southern California. And I would be driving around and I'd hear promos on the radio for new sitcoms. And I'd hear the delivery of a joke or a line and think, oh, you're pushing it too hard. You got to remember that for when you do it. What? I would just hear myself thinking and making mental notes about how to, you know, deliver a joke better.
How delusional you were.
Isn't that weird? And it just kept happening. And so I finally just surrendered and said, all right, I'm going to give it a try.
Huh.
Yeah. And then John Lovitz is my brother's best friend. I grew up with him.
The comedian and actor.
Right. And he had just gotten on Saturday Night Live. And I thought, oh, okay. So it's not some like miracle that happens to certain people born under a lucky star. So, yeah, he really inspired me to pursue it.
And how did you pursue it?
He sent me to the Groundlings.
Uh-huh.
Improvisation sketch comedy theater company.
The second city of L.A., kind of.
Right. Exactly.
And then Friends, which you did for 10 years, and I almost feel as though we don't need to play a clip because if you haven't heard or seen Friends by now, then I don't know what rock you've been living under, but here is a clip of your character, Phoebe Buffay, meeting her fiancé's parents for the first time.
It's Tom and Sue Engel.
Phoebe, hello. Come sit. Okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Mm-hmm. So where are you from?
Originally, I'm from upstate. But then my mom killed herself and my stepdad went to prison, so I just moved to the city where I actually lived in a burned-out Buick LeSabre for a while, which was okay. That was okay until I got hepatitis, you know, because this pimp spit in my mouth. And but I got over it. And anyway, now I'm a freelance massage therapist, which, you know, isn't always steady money, but at least I don't pay taxes.
That is.
It's like I'm hearing it for the first time.
Well, I tell you, it. I sort of discovered it entirely in reruns, and now every time my children say, "Oh, you got to watch this one," I happily do. That was Lisa Kudrow in one of her brilliant episodes of Friends. Do you have, as again, my devoted children do, favorite episodes and favorite seasons? Are you a Friends geek in that sense?
No. And while I do like it when I see it and I end up laughing and saying, oh, God, it really was a funny show, I don't remember one episode. You know, it's brand almost new.
Or really?
It's a – yeah. I really don't remember. After I'm done working on something, it's done. I mean, I've almost purged it from my memory and move on to the next thing.
One of the achievements of your character in that show, it seems to me, was that while she could have been this – cartoon, she was always surprising and never became this complete caricature of Loon.
Yeah, of a spacey girl. Well, but I always thought no one's truly that dumb and that, you know, it's always a surprise to them when they've got it wrong or, you know, and that's always the funniest thing. And I felt like I became more like Phoebe.
Really?
Yeah, that was nice.
Well, that's spending a lot of time in Los Angeles makes you that way or what?
No, spending a lot of time as Phoebe,
really?
I think, can
so
make
how did that
way.
Manifest itself?
I started just to not try to show everybody that I'm actually smart. And I lost a lot of vocabulary. That was actually happening before. I think that happened from deciding to become an actor. It's kind of off-putting to other people I found when I'd be in a class or something and then I'd say a word that they didn't know and they just felt bad.
You were over 40 by the time Friends ended and you did a show, a really interesting show on HBO called The Comeback.
Thank you.
How was that experience?
That was one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done.
Because?
Because I was allowed to write it with Michael Patrick King.
Who was other work he's well known for is Sex and the City.
Right.
And that character, who was this actress, has been, might be too strong, but she's past her prime.
Right.
having just come off of Friends, was that potentially autobiographical?
No. I thought that if people thought that it was autobiographical, it would make it a little more interesting and maybe draw people to see it in the beginning. And maybe that is what happened for the first episode. But it was so brutal, you know, and then it's clearly not me.
Yes.
It didn't make me nervous at all.
Okay. We're ready for you. You're ready for us?
Yes, I am.
Well, I got it.
Valerie?
Yeah.
Could you do it again?
Sure, yeah. Was there a technical
something? No, I just, I think it could be a little bigger, you know, more excited.
Can do. Okay. Ready? Yeah. Well, I got it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just the whole comeback is about how excited you are. Mm-hmm.
Well, I am excited.
Right, but they didn't let us film them actually telling you, so this needs to be the big event.
Right, okay. Sure, I gotcha. Okay. Ready? Okay. Well, I got it. And I thought it was...
Could you do it again?
I'm sorry. I think it's hilarious.
That is Lisa Kudrow as Valerie Cherish.
Enjoying herself.
Enjoying herself a great deal. You have recently participated in this documentary series that I don't think has aired yet called Who Do You Think You Are, where you trace your roots back. What did you discover?
Well, the researchers trace our lineage and then take us to the places of, you know, our ancestors' origin and show us original documents. And it's fantastic. Mine was a Holocaust story, and I went to Belarus. And
which is a pretty horrible place, yeah?
It's not great. It's not a tourist destination, that's for sure. Let me put it this way. I felt a lot of relief when we were going to Poland. Yay, finally. But it was tough. It was a tough trip. And to actually walk the same path that my great-grandmother did, you know, on the way to her death it's powerful. And then there's other stuff they found that was even more surprising and unbelievable. And as an audience member, you cannot believe this is happening, and it's not scripted.
Which suggests that it's not just famous actors who would have a surprise, that any and all of us, if we did the same thing, would find such a surprise.
Exactly. Yeah.
Lisa Kudrow, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are two places to watch Lisa Kudrow on TV right now. Season 4 of Web Therapy is on Showtime, and the extremely long-awaited second season of The Comeback is on HBO. We don't observe a lot of holiday rituals here at Studio 360, but one thing we do love as the year comes to an end is highlighting the year's new entries in the National Recording Registry. That's the Library of Congress's program to recognize and preserve historic recordings, music, comedy, speeches, anything great and audio. Our 2014 series continues today with Celia Cruz, the Queen of Salsa. Pensando, creyendo las falsas promesas que hacía. Ojalá puedas hacerle muy feliz. Cruz had been a big singing star in Cuba in the 50s. When the revolution happened, she was here in the U.S. and stayed, joining Tito Puente's band. But a decade and a half later, middle-aged and in a career slump, she teamed up with one of her biggest fans, Johnny Pacheco, co-founder of a new Latin music label called Fania Records. They released the album Celia and Johnny in 1974 using a small band that left a lot of room for vocal improvisation by Cruz. The record was a gigantic hit and helped put salsa music on the map. To tell the story of Celia and Johnny, we've got a music professor.
My name is Marisol Berrios Miranda, and I am a professor of music, ethnomusicology, and Latin American studies.
Celia Cruz's biographer.
My name is Ana Cristina Raimundo, and I am the co-author of a book called Celia, My Life, an Autobiography with Celia Cruz.
And Johnny himself.
My name is Johnny Pacheco. I'm a musician. I'm a band leader. I was a lousy violin player for I was very well known as a percussionist.
Ladies and gentlemen, here they are, the world's greatest Latin musicians, the Fania All-Stars! Yeah!
I always wanted to start my own company because I had ideas different from what was going on.
If he was not for Fania Records, we would not be talking about all of this delicious, rich music.
Fania Records began in the 60s.
Johnny started recording Latin artists in New York.
I always wanted to record Celia. I never worked with anybody so talented. She sang like nobody sang before.
Hey mama, hey mama, hey mama, hey mama.
Celia Cruz, with her incredible flamboyant costumes, her 3-inch nails, her flashy smile, her warmth, she was an energy master. She would sing, and the whole vibration of the room would just be raised.
La rumba me está llamando. Bongo, dile que ya voy.
To me, it was a dream come true, playing with Celia and recording Celia. We became like family.
Celia and Johnny is such an important record because it was something that he did for her. He wanted to highlight her voice and her extraordinary ability to express emotion.
Hey mama, hey mama.
When you start listening to Kimbara, you cannot stay still. You had to dance. When I am dancing and I hear Celia shouting Azúcar, the energy goes even one more notch up.
I remember when she walked into the studio, she used to say to us, Azúcar, sugar. That's an expression of sweetness.
We have a saying in Spanish, and that is, traía la música por dentro. She had the music within her. Celia was born in Cuba, where music and rhythm is like the air that you breathe.
Voy a cantarle a mi tierra, Cuba. Ay, pero La Habana, qué linda.
Cuba is always been very, very important in the salsa Afro-Cuban continuum.
Cosa cubano de la banda acá.
Salsa is the music from Cuba, New York.
The term means sauce, salsa, sauce.
There was always this debate between Tito and Johnny, and Tito would say, Johnny, pero que la salsa se come and no se toca. We eat salsa. We don't dance it. We don't play it. And then Johnny would laugh, and he would say, Tito, the kids don't know that. The generation of today thinks of guaracha, guaguancó, mambo, all of this as their grandparents' and their parents' music.
So what I did was we put the music under one roof and called it salsa.
It was a really, I think, a truly brilliant marketing strategy to repackage these amazing, beloved rhythms that were completely familiar to the people.
I'll never forget the look on people's faces when we performed. The guys from the Bronx playing salsa.
One of the most beautiful things about salsa and that new way of arranging sones and guarachas and mambos and bombas, all of that make that music very, very inclusive.
When I was rehearsing with the band, I saw that there were Dominicans.
Johnny is from Dominican Republic, you know.
Cuban, Puerto Rican, and 2 Jewish fellows.
So we have a combination of different nationalities.
And when you make a sauce, you have different ingredients. And when I saw the band on the stage, I said, this is what we got. We got salsa.
Alma de carabalí.
That was Johnny Pacheco remembering his 1974 album, Celia and Johnny. It's just been entered into the U.S. government's National Recording Registry. We also heard from Ana Cristina Raimundo and Marisol Berrios Miranda. Our story was produced by Devin Strolovich for BMP Audio. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. And we've got great news stories every day on our blog at studio360.org/sideshow. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azoulay,
Scott Ross.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannett. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, putting on concerts for wolves.
Until we teach the animals capitalism, I don't expect to be collecting any money at the door. So I can't pay anyone. I haven't been paid. And everyone who's helped me with these has donated their time.
Do animals have culture? We'll find out next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.